This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Julia Swag. Julia Swag is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she directs the Global Brazil Initiative. And it just so happens that we grew up as neighbors years ago. Julia Swag, it's great to see you again. How'd you get interested in Brazil?
Thanks for having me, Matt. It's great to be here. You know, people that grew up studying Latin America of my generation, so I was in college in the 1980s, largely were divided between people that studied Latin America, Spanish-speaking South America, and then everyone else who did Brazil, worked on Brazil. And I was in the Latin America corner, and only quite recently, that is in the last 5 years, have taken a deep dive into learning Brazil because it's important, because it's interesting, and it's new to me.
And it's one of these, you know, you hear about these up-and-coming huge countries to compete against the United States, the BRIC countries. The B stands for Brazil, Brazil, Russia, India, China, I guess. And for a long time, people were just saying Brazil. Everyone always says it's going to be a big, great country, and it's never going to be a big, great country. But it seems like those naysayers are being proven wrong.
Yes. The Brazil is the hot ticket globally right now, and there are real substantial reasons for that. The economy is now the sixth largest in the world. It's the fifth largest population in the world, fifth largest land mass, and over the last 10 years has seen very, very solid growth in a very complicated global economic environment, but also has a very successful social inclusion agenda. So domestically, 40 million people have gone from poverty into the lower middle class. Internationally, Brazil is playing on the global stage in a bunch of different spaces, and it's very appealing and important to not just Wall Street, but also increasingly a variety of American and global institutions to understand what's happening there.
The previous president, who went by the name Lula, was a fascinating figure, is a fascinating figure, with pluses and minuses. Give us a picture of him.
Luiz Inácio da Silva, whose nickname is Lula, was a founding member of the Workers' Party, the PT in Brazil. And he was also, as were many of the people running the country today, part of the activities, political and sometimes often underground activities, aimed at overthrowing the military regime that was in power between in the 60s until the 1980s. So he has a very important political history as a labor organizer and then as a founding member of this Workers' Party, which is dominant today in the country. He ran for president 4 times, and for 3 of them lost, and in the 4th, he finally won and became president and spent 2 terms in office. And he was notable for having had only a fifth grade education, for coming from the working classes, from having had a very, very difficult childhood in a country in which elite politics, the old oligarchy, the military had dominated the scene. So he was and is sort of along with his predecessor, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, really a breakout example of a new political leader in Brazil.
And he did some strange things with Ahmadinejad in Iran. Why did he cozy up to Ahmadinejad? That seems strange to me.
So the Iran story that you're talking about took place over the course of 2009 and 2010, in the last couple of years of his presidency. And to answer your question, I have to take a little bit of time because the cozy up factor was definitely the major headline and takeaway that I think Americans saw out of that. Brazilian foreign policy under President Lula and under his foreign minister, Celso Amorim, was very keyed in on showing that new emerging powers such as Brazil might well have the ability to mediate conflicts and prevent conflicts that traditional Western powers, NATO powers, the United States, the UK, had been quite bad at averting. They saw the two wars in Iraq as very detrimental, counterproductive, the fabrication of intelligence as something quite anathema. And in Brazil, trying to make for itself a place on the world stage, took from the Iraq experience an opportunity to perhaps play a role mediating on Iran.
I'm speaking with Julia Swag. She's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she directs the Global Brazil Initiative. Other than that, though, I was kind of a big fan of Lula's, and you talked about social inclusion earlier. I mean, he did help enormously lift people out of poverty and also on education rates, right?
Well, yes, that the whole agenda of what in technical terms you would call human capital development on public health, on education, and on basic sort of, you think of it as great society programs, if you wanted to put it into an American context, he was extremely effective. And unlike the United States today, in Brazil over the last 10 years, there has really developed, and he has been part of, central to this, a domestic political consensus, left and right, that the state has to spend money to invest in people, especially very poor people.
Yeah, it's different than we have here in the United States right now.
Substantially so.
Now, bring us to the new president, Dilma Rousseff. What's she like?
I'm really lucky because I've had the opportunity to meet her twice and to spend some time with her very, very recently. If you think of Lula as having put Brazil on the map globally, think about Dilma Rousseff as the person who was at home minding the domestic front. She was his Minister of Mines and Energy, Chief of Staff. When he had a corruption scandal that almost brought down his government, she was the one who built and rebuilt the political coalition that helped him get reelected. She, like Lula, has a very interesting political history. She was, at 16, joined a cell of a student underground anti-regime movement in the late 60s, and in 1971 was arrested and spent 3 years in jail, during which time she was tortured. And she lived through this, survived it, and remade her life, as did many Brazilian and many Brazilian women with whom she was imprisoned. Mm.
So in a way, it was like the Bachelet story in Chile a little bit.
It's similar to the Bachelet story. In Dilma's case, what is remarkable, I think, about her and some of the women who are now in her cabinet, whom I've also met, is although they are pushing on bringing to justice some of the people involved in disappearances and torture, they're also using the tools of the state to advance, as Bachelet did, major laws and other institutional protections to deal with violence against women, domestic violence, and women's public health.
Talk to me about that, because I read an article you wrote about the Secretary for Women's Affairs there, and I'm having trouble with her, Minakuchi, I think her name is. But tell me about that effort and how prevalent domestic abuse is in Brazil, how macho the culture is. They have this first female president. How are they dealing with that? But especially these efforts to curb domestic abuse.
Well, during the campaign, Dilma was sort of handpicked by Lula to run as the PT's candidate. And there was a lot of chatter by the predominantly male pundits in Brazil that she was going to just be controlled by Lula. Her agenda, just to get to domestic violence, that also started under Lula, to his credit. And Brazil has passed what the UN and many experts describe as the most far-reaching and effective domestic violence laws in the world. That's also related to public health, maternal health for women, access to courts, access to police and other kinds of protections, and very importantly, to introduce information that comes from anonymous tips into court systems that would be admissible in court so that women who are fearful of coming forward themselves can do so anonymously or have friends and family do so. Domestic violence against women in Brazil historically has been notoriously high, and also sexual violence against women and girls also is a major problem. And I think, you know, when I did interview the minister, my impression was that they're still in very early days in terms of implementation. But there's a big public education effort and, importantly, the political will. There's also pushback. You know, Brazil has a strong Catholic Church. It has a strong evangelical movement, neither of which forwardly endorse domestic violence against women, but both of which also have a lot of ambivalence about women's empowerment.
And is abortion legal in Brazil?
It's legal. Abortion is legal in Brazil only for victims of rape. And now for people who are carrying fetuses that have fetal encephalitis. So it's very, very restricted.
I'm speaking with Julia Swag. She's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she directs the Global Brazil Initiative. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Brazil in foreign policy, and you were talking a little bit about Iran there for a second, but also has tried to branch out outside the U.S. kind of sphere. The United States, under Obama at least, rhetorically had talked about a new U.S. policy toward Latin America, one that is not seen as a one is equal partners, I think was Obama's phrase, as opposed to the old traditional way. And yet, seems to me anyway, that though the rhetoric's different, the policy seems to be pretty much the same, especially if you look at the coup in Honduras, for instance, or U.S.-Cuba policy. Anyway, that's my assessment. What's yours on Obama Latin America policy?
Yeah, I think I want to write an article that actually lays out what the, say, 10 major features of Bush Latin America policy were and the 10 major features of Obama, and I think we'd be able to see a lot more continuity than change under Obama. The basic problem, in my view, is that domestic politics are far more important in driving foreign policy toward Latin America than national interest. And by domestic politics, what I mean is two things. One, there's an old Cold War ideological overhang. So in the Congress, the people that tend to care about Latin America tend to be focused on Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba. They want to sort of find the countries that hate us or that they think hate us and focus our energy on destabilizing them. The other issue is, in terms of substance, trade policy, war on drugs, immigration, agriculture, Cuba, there's all big domestic constituents that are, you know, have electoral implications. So you see difficulty moving Obama off the dime. His rhetoric sounds good, but the sort of partnership issues, you know, the bottom line is, this is an administration that is focused on the Middle East. This is an administration that's focused on China. Latin America's very stability, its democratic nature, its peaceful nature, means that the United States doesn't pay too much attention, and that might not be such a bad thing.
I know there are a lot of Latin America scholars and activists who thought that with the United States engaged in the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, that gave room for someone like not just Lula in Brazil, but Chavez in Venezuela to go a different way. Though there was interference, certainly there was a coup attempt against Chavez.
Yes, there was.
That sent him out of power for about 48 hours. And I'm sure Cheney is gritting his teeth today as to why the CIA didn't just go up and kill him, because that is the standard way. What do you make of Chavez?
You know, the United States really did, just to riff on one thing that you just said, the United States really did pull back after 9/11 and created a vacuum of diplomacy and influence, and into that vacuum stepped a bunch of new leaders. But it wasn't that they arose only because the United States wasn't paying attention, but because the democratic spaces in the region opened up a lot. Social movements put people in office. Chavez is very much a product of his own and Venezuela's own political history. Two political parties closely tied to the elite had a lock on oil rents and wealth in the country for 40 years. And the sort of, if you ever go to Caracas and you drive in from the airport, you see the, you know, horrendous conditions in which people live. Chavez emerges from that. What I think of Chavez is that his grab on executive power has been pretty egregious, but at the same time, he has never had an effective opposition to do the real politics that you have to do to take him on. And that's because they haven't had a set of ideas about how to deal with that same agenda in Brazil, the social inclusion agenda.
And how has Chavez done on the social inclusion?
Well, I mean, initially he did pretty well. And you saw rates in poverty go down. You saw, you know, a lot of upheaval in the oil industry. You saw sort of boots on the ground in terms of public services, social services. Some of them were Cuban boots on the ground. And money going from the state into his political supporters, their neighborhoods, and into sort of the spaces that they had control of. That has started really to take a turn. Inflation is up. The economy is not doing so well. And the social deterioration is evident.
Mm-hmm. What about U.S. policy toward Cuba? I know that Obama did a little bit of loosening, or seemed to be loosening at the beginning, but then it's just, it seems like the same old Cold War now, what, 62 years after the Cuban Revolution?
Yeah, 62 or 52. I can't believe,
52, excuse
Matt,
me.
That we are still having a conversation about a policy that hasn't changed largely in the last 50 years. I mean, truly, I'm shocked by that. And it has to do with domestic politics purely. But what's weird about that is that we're told that Cuban Americans are the reason that we can't change policy because they wouldn't tolerate it. But Cuban Americans, even though they vote Republican, are also voting with their feet. 400,000 of them traveled to Cuba last year. They're sending money to their families, helping to start small businesses. And I think the president is making a huge mistake by not more substantially overhauling U.S. policy. He would get major cred in Latin America, where he doesn't really have it any longer. And he would go down in history as the person with the political will to write a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban policy, which he himself in 2009 hinted at doing but then pulled back from.
And what would that new chapter say?
Well, what would it say? It would say, we treaded water for 50 years and have, as a result of having a far-reaching economic embargo against Cuba and a travel ban banning our own citizens, made the United States largely irrelevant to the substantial changes that are taking place in Cuba today under Raul Castro. Cuba is a country that 10 years from now will, by comparison to where it's been, be largely unrecognizable. 50% of the economy will be have moved into private hands. And does the United States want to have some kind of role 90 miles away? The new chapter would be to shape that role.
And so you're for lifting the embargo?
So, yes, I said that in a convoluted way. Yes, we ought to get rid of the embargo, lift the travel ban, allow Americans to invest, allow Cubans and Americans to know one another, connect our two societies, and hope that the governments get out of the way. And we should do so unilaterally.
Why is Raul Castro making these changes?
Well, Raul Castro is 82. His brother is 87. I believe Raul has a very clear sense that the clock is ticking and that for the basic legacy of the Cuban Revolution to survive, and I think of that legacy as a healthy dose of nationalism in terms of independent foreign policy and a commitment to social inclusion, social justice domestically, Cubans have to become productive. They have to shrink the size of the state. They have to create a political and an economic and a social environment in which the social contract is entirely rewritten. And that if they don't do that now, once the founding mothers and fathers are gone, no way to judge what could happen.
Have you been to Cuba?
Yes, I have been traveling to Cuba since 1984.
Oh, that's lucky.
Been there 40 or 50 times.
No kidding.
My first two of my books that I've written are about Cuba. Yes, so yes, I've been there a lot.
And how has it changed since you've, in the 20 some,
too
almost
many,
couple decades you've been there?
Well, when I first went there, Cuba was living off the fat of the Soviet Union and had a multi-billion-dollar annual subsidy and was part of this thing, if you remember, called Comecon, this like massive barter trade system with all of the Soviet bloc member countries. That was in the 1980s. Social controls, control over speech and assembly, highly controlled. The 1990s, was a period of slightly more openness and experimentation. I would say in the last 10 years, but especially in the last five since Fidel Castro stepped aside, there's a greater space for debate than ever before since I've been traveling there. And the place is changing in ways that I think cannot be rolled back.
It's crazy to talk about Cuba here in the United States because you're not allowed to say, as Ozzie Guillen, the manager of the Marlins in Miami, found out, you're not allowed to say that you admire Fidel Castro. At least you're not allowed to say it in Miami. Doesn't that strike you as totally backward?
Well, I mean, I think Miami has a real problem with freedom of speech. And it wasn't just Ozzy. You know, a couple of years ago, the artist, musician Juanes from Colombia, who lives in Miami, he was Dixie-chicked. He had his CDs rolled over by a tractor when he wanted to go and give a concert down in Havana that he did and that brought a million people into the Plaza of the Revolution. I think Miami, the radios, the televisions, the media there are still dominated by the old-school hardliners who are oddly mirroring their counterparts on the island that want to control speech and a lot more.
What is the human rights record of Cuba right now as far as speech goes and dissent?
Well, one of the things that fortunately Raul Castro did was to negotiate a way for almost all of Cuba's political prisoners to leave the prisons and to leave the country, some of them in Spain, some of them are in the United States, some of them are in Cuba. But you know, if you look at the major newspapers that are published there, you don't see a lot. It's not substantially better than it was 5 or 6 years ago. Some investigations on corruption, letters to the editor, a little bit more transparency. You do see in the blogosphere and digitally much more freedom of speech. But I would say that, you know, you still have one party system. It's the Communist Party. There's not a lot of transparency about the party's deliberations and internal factions. Dissent is vastly more tolerated than it ever was before. But dissidents, that is organized dissidents, especially those that are receiving money, especially from the United States, are shunned and repressed.
You know, when the Ozzie Guillen thing broke, the thing that struck me was just the hyperbole that people are using about the Castros, calling him Hitler. And if I don't hear the Hitler analogy one more time, you know, it would be a miracle. You know, I've lived too long if I hear it once more, because it's such an erroneous metaphor almost all the time that it's applied, and especially in this instance where if you compare the other regimes in Latin America over the last 40 years with the Cuban Revolution, I mean, their human rights record isn't nearly as bad, and I'm no apologist for Cuba's human rights record. I'm a big believer in free speech and free assembly and dissent, but Lord have mercy, look at what happened in El Salvador and under the Somozas and under the Baby Doc and all of the stuff in Latin America, Brazil, under the dictatorship that you were talking about earlier, Julia Swag. That just strikes me as an imbalance in people's minds. Julia Swag is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she directs the Global Brazil Initiative. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. We got an election coming up. And I'm wondering how you assess Mitt Romney's likely foreign policy.
From the debates and from this campaign, what we see so far is a struggle, I think, from Romney to position himself to the right of Barack Obama. I mean, one of the things that's happened under Obama's foreign policy is that Republican foreign policy thinkers are actually quite pleased. They see a lot of continuity generally from Dick Cheney's agenda globally, vis-a-vis torture, vis-a-vis rendition, vis-a-vis drones. That is, there's a lot more continuity than change. So I would say that once and if elected, we would see Romney continue by and large, maybe with some tougher talk, maybe with a few more global hotspot involvements, what we've seen under Obama, by and large.
This is the continuity in U.S. foreign policy that has struck me over the last certainly years of the Obama administration, and I guess we got a hint of it during the campaign when he praised George H.W. Bush's foreign policy, and it's basically been a continuation. You mentioned Cheney. It's weird. Cheney calls Obama an unmitigated disaster, but as you point out, he's followed a lot of what Cheney and Junior Bush were doing themselves. What advice do you give to people who want to see a better U.S. foreign policy, or a more humane, I would say a more progressive foreign policy? How do we break out of this consensus?
You know, I really have, and I was going to mention this, have been very struck by how constrained debate is in Washington, D.C. right now. The agenda has moved to the right, and the progressives in the Democratic Party and progressives or moderates in the Republican Party are increasingly a dying breed. And I really do have kind of an old-fashioned faith in writing your congressperson, in weighing in. You know, the staffers that are sitting in those offices are actually having to respond to constituents. And constituent input matters a great deal. And I think sometimes we forget that and just kind of give up. But that would start with square one. And the second thing is, I would like to see some of the Occupy Wall Street movement actually try to take on, and maybe not Occupy Wall Street, but some sort of, you know, in the street noisemaking. We saw, I mean, for those of us that grew up in the Vietnam War or Central America, we haven't seen very much public opposition. George Bush told us to go shopping after 9/11, and we shopped ourselves into huge debt. And I think we need to sort of start thinking about how spending abroad and putting our people in harm's way actually does have a direct relevance to our own domestic health and well-being.
There was some anti-war activity, but you know, against the Iraq War, a lot actually before Bush started it, and then there was some, and then when Obama came in, it faded. And even though Obama escalated the Afghan War, and now promises to de-escalate it, there weren't a lot of protests. That was the kind of anesthesia that Obama gave the left movement in the United States.
Yes, Obama was very disorienting, and I think we'll, for a second term, the progressive movement will see him as a little bit more complicated than he appears.
Complicated in what way?
Well, complicated in that he's not, I mean, he's an African-American man who was a community organizer, and right there the takeaway is, oh, gee, he must be a progressive. But he has quite traditional conservative views on many, many things, as we've seen in the way he's governed. And part of that is, I think, the Washington machine kind of eating the presidency alive. It's very hard. The presidency is a great bully pulpit, but the institutional demands and the fundraising demands are also tremendous. But I think his instincts seem to be to mollify and mediate rather than to confront.
Yeah, he's not a confrontational person. You mentioned community organizing, and I remember reading an article you took off on something Newt Gingrich was saying about Saul Alinsky.
Yeah.
And you were saying the same thing that I had noted, that wow, he pulled Saul Alinsky out of a hat practically, and that the reference to Saul Alinsky, who no one knew in his audience, in his Republican audience certainly, and in the vast American audience outside the left, you pointed out that there were hints of anti-Semitism there. Talk about that for a second. We only have about 30 seconds. I thought it was so strange, though.
Strange that I pointed it
out? No, strange that he was doing it.
Well, it was weird. I watched him do it in his acceptance speech when he won South Carolina, and it just jumped out at me. But I think when you lump Saul Alinsky, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton into one mush, which he did, it's code for anti-Semitic, racist, feelings that he was trying to elicit from his audience. Yeah. I knew who Saul Alinsky was because I grew up in Chicago.
Yeah, Saul Alinsky, socialist. And then, you know, that was all one phrase. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been a fascinating conversation. My guest has been Julia Swag. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she directs the Global Brazil Initiative. Julia, it's been great talking with you.
Matt, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.